This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. It's time. Indeed, it's overtime to rename the Edmund Pettus Bridge, named after a former Confederate Brigadier General and Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, for Congressman John Lewis. Congressman John Lewis, who gave his hands for his entire life to dismantle the system of plantation capitalism. Congressman John Lewis, presente. Now, a Building Bridges exclusive with Congressman John Lewis in one of his last addresses to hundreds of public workers of Local 371, District Council 37.
You have a rare opportunity to see history, live history, learn history, and be in the presence of greatness of a humble man who gave of himself for many years. It is my honor, it is my pleasure.
Mr. President, thank you. It is good to be in a house of labor one more time. Let me say to all of the members of the different unions, to all of the honorable elected officials, to each and every one of you, I must tell you that I'm delighted, very happy, and very pleased to be here. You're a good-looking group. Are you beautiful, handsome, you're fired up, and you're ready to go. Now, I didn't grow up in a big city like New York City, Buffalo or Syracuse, Chicago or Atlanta. I grew up in rural Alabama, 50 miles from Montgomery. Yeah. Outside of a little place called Troy. Yeah. My father was a sharecropper, but in 1944, when I was 4 years old, how many of you remember when you were four? No. What happened to the rest of us? Well, in 1944, my father had saved $300. And a man sold him 110 acres of land. And on his farm, and we still own this land today, on his farm there is a lot of cotton and corn, peanuts, hogs, cows, and chicken. Now tonight we have some chicken, some of us did, I know. Now, I know some of you like to eat chicken, right? But you don't know anything about raising chicken, right? Why don't we compare notes? But growing up there on that farm, it became my responsibility to care for the chickens. And I fell in love with raising chickens. If you listen for just one moment, let me tell you what I had to do as a young boy, about 8 or 9 years old. When the setting hen was set, I had to take the fresh eggs and mark them with a pencil, place them in the setting hen, and wait for 3 long weeks for the little chicks to hatch. Some of you may be saying, now, John Lewis, why do you mark those fresh eggs with a pencil before you place them under the setting hen? Well, from time to time, another hen would get on that same nest, and there would be some more eggs. And you had to be able to get the fresh eggs from the eggs that were already under the setting hen. You follow me?
Yes.
You don't follow me. No, no, you don't follow me. So when these little chicks were hatched, I would fool these setting hens. I would cheat on these setting hens. I would take these little chicks and give them to another hen. I'd put them in a box with a lantern, raise them on their own, get some more fresh eggs, mark them with a pencil, place them under their setting hen, and encourage the setting hen to stay in the nest for another 3 weeks. It was not the right thing to do. It's not the most loving thing to do. It's not the most nonviolent thing to do. But I was never quite able to save $18.98 to order the most inexpensive incubator, a hatchet, for this little butt show. Now, maybe not in New York City. You probably don't know that much about this little butt catalog. Any of you old enough to remember? That big book? That heavy book? That thick book? Some people call it the Bush book. I wish I had this. I wish I had that. So just keep on cheating on yourself again. It was not the right thing to do. It was not the moral thing to do. But I just couldn't save enough money. So when I was a little child, about 8 or 9 years old, I wanted to be a minister. I wanted to preach the gospel. So from time to time, with the help of my brothers and sisters and my cousins, I grew up with 6 brothers and 3 sisters, many, many first cousins. But we would gather all of our chickens together in the chicken yard, like you're gathered here. And my brothers and sisters and cousins were lying outside, but around the chicken yard, and I would start speaking and preaching. And when I looked back on it, some of these chickens were about their heads. Some of these chickens would shake their heads. They never quite said amen. But I'm convinced that some of those chickens that I preached to in the 40s and the 50s tended to listen to me much better than some of my colleagues listened to me in the 80s. And some of those chickens were just a little more productive, at least they produce a egg. That's enough of that story. When we were visiting the little town of Troy, visit Montgomery, visit Tuskegee, visit Birmingham, I saw those signs that said white men, colored men, white women, colored women, white waiting, colored waiting, to go downtown on a Saturday afternoon to the theater to see a movie. All of us little black children had to go upstairs to the balcony. And all of the little white children went downstairs to the first floor. Came home and I asked my mother, my father, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, why? They would say, that's the way it is. Don't get in the way. Don't get in trouble. But in 1955, 15 years old, in the 10th grade, I heard of Rosa Parks. I heard the words of Martin Luther King Jr. The action of Rosa Parks, the words and leadership of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired me to find a way to get in the way, to get in trouble. I got in trouble. Good trouble, necessary trouble. So inspired by what was happening in Montgomery, 50 miles away. And in 1956, at the age of 16, with some of my brothers and sisters and cousins, we went down to the public library, trying to get a library card, trying to check out some books. And we were told by the librarian that the library was for whites only and not for colors. I never went back to that building until July 5th, 1998, for book signing of my first book. Hundreds of blacks and white citizens showed up. They had a little reception, signed some books. End of the program, they gave me a library card. It says something about the distance we've come and the progress we've made in laying down the burden of race. Now, as a little child, 17 years old, I wanted to attend a college only about 10 miles from my home called Troy State College, now known as Troy University. I never heard a word from the school. I submitted an application, my high school transcript. So I wrote a letter to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I didn't tell my mother, my father, any of my sisters or brothers, any of my teachers. I told Dr. King I needed his help. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote me back and sent me a round-trip Greyhound bus ticket, invited me to come to Montgomery to meet with him. In the meantime, I had been accepted at a little college in Nashville, Tennessee. An uncle of mine gave me a $100 bill and a footlocker. I put everything that I owned in that footlocker, except those chickens, and took a Greyhound bus to Nashville. And after being in Nashville, Tennessee for about 3 weeks, I told one of my teachers that I've been in contact with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. This teacher informed Dr. King that I was there in Nashville. Martin Luther King Jr. got back in church and suggested when I was home for spring break to come and see him. So on a Saturday morning in March of 1958, 18 years old by now, I traveled from Troy to Montgomery. And an African-American lawyer by the name of Fred Gray.
Yes.
He was a lawyer for Rosa Parks, for Dr. King, and became our lawyer during the Freedom Rides and during the March from Selma to Montgomery. Met me at the Greyhound bus station and drove me to the First Baptist Church, pastored by the Reverend Ralph Abernathy, a colleague of Dr. King, involved in the Montgomery bus boycott, and ushered me into the pastor's study. I saw Martin Luther King Jr. and Ralph Abernathy standing behind the desk. I was so scared I didn't know what to say or what to do. And Dr. King said, "Well, you're John Lewis. You're the boy from Troy." And I said, "Dr. King, I am John Robert Lewis." He gave my whole name. He started calling me the boy from Troy. I had a discussion with my mother and my father about what Dr. King said, that we may have to sue Troy State, the state of Alabama, not Troy University. A home could be bombed, a burn. We can lose the land. And I went back and had a discussion with my mother and my father. They were so afraid. So I continued to study in Nashville. And I met Rosa Parks, and I would see Dr. King from time to time when he would come to speak. And with hundreds of students, we got involved in the sit-in movement. By sitting down, by sitting in, we were standing up. So what you see happening today with the Women March,
yes.
What you see happen at the airports, people are standing up. It is time for organized labor. To stand up, to speak up, speak out, and get in the way, get in trouble, good trouble, necessary trouble. And let me just say, you know, no one want to go to jail. No one want to be beaten. But I was arrested in jail 40 times during the 60s. The first time I got arrested was during the sit-ins. There were black and white college students and some high school students. Students and young people from all across America, from New York City, they came south to study. We studied the way of peace. We studied the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence. We studied the way of love. We'd be sitting down on a stool at a lunch counter, or sitting in at a restaurant, and someone would come up and spit on us. Put a light cigarette out in our hair, or down our backs, pour hot water, hot coffee, or hot chocolate on us. And then we were told, in order to continue to sit in, you're going to be arrested. Never been arrested before. Never seen the inside of a jail. But I thought about it and said to myself, if I go to jail, if I get arrested and go to jail, I wanted to look what some young people would call fresh. I wanted to look clean. I wanted to look sharp. So a few days before the next sit-in, I went to a used men's store and bought a used suit. A vest came with it. I paid $5 for this suit. And if you have an opportunity to come to Washington and visit my congressional office, have a very large photograph of me being arrested with 87 other young men and women. I look sharp. I did look clean. So sometimes we must learn to disturb the order of things. Sometimes we have to speak with our feet. Sometimes we have to speak with our hands. But whatever you do, as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said over and over again, keep moving. That's what we did on the march from Selma to Montgomery. We spoke up. We spoke out, and we got in the way. We got in trouble. We were beaten. We were left bloody. I almost died on that bridge. Had a concussion. But just like a few short years ago. The heart of the American South, people could not register to vote simply because of the color of their skin. People asked to count the number of bubbles in a bar of soap, the number of jelly beans in a jar. And some people said today it is hard, it is difficult. But anything worth having, it is going to be hard. Just remember, you must remember that three young men, two from New York City and one from Mississippi that I knew, James. Nicky Schrein and James Chaney,
yeah,
and Andrew Goodman,
right,
gave their lives. They died not in the Middle East, not in Africa or Central or South America. But these three young men went out to investigate the brain of an African-American church used for voter registration workshop. Detained by the sheriff. Took them to the Klan, where they were beaten, shot, murdered, and buried on a mound of dirt. And some of us are going to say today, it is hard. Look, we got to hang in there.
Yes.
We got to hang in there. There are forces in Washington today and across America that want to take us back. But we're not going back. We've come too far. We're not going back. We're going to follow up. Since I've been in Congress, I've been arrested another 5 times. My last arrest for trying to get the former Speaker of the House to bring forth comprehensive immigration reform bill.
Yes.
If the Speaker had brought this bill forth, almost every single Democrat would have voted for it, and we would have got enough Republican, and President Barack Obama would have signed it into law. So we can't stop now. We cannot say we are tired and we are weary. Look, when you see something that is not right, not fair, not just, give a moral obligation, a mission, and a mandate to stand up, say something. You cannot be silent. You cannot afford it. So I want to congratulate this union.
Yes.
And all members of union.
Yes.
I want to congratulate organized labor, period. I want to congratulate the women that participated in the women's march. And the thousand and thousand turn out here in New York.
Yes.
More than 500,000 in Washington, D.C. And even in a small city like Atlanta, we had more than 63,000 people. And last Sunday evening at the airport, we had more than 5,000 people there. I marched with them, I walked with them. So I said to you tonight, don't get weary. Don't get lost in the sea of despair. Keep the faith. Keep your eyes on the prize. Keep pushing. Keep pulling. And make it uncomfortable for those who try to take us back. Disturb the order of things. Get in the way. Get in trouble. Good trouble. Necessary trouble. We can do it. Election, we all got to get out and vote like we never ever. We cannot afford to stay home. The vote is precious. It's almost sacred. It is the most powerful, non-violent instrument or tool we have in a democratic society. Only thing, I gave a little blood on that bridge. Some people gave their very lives. So let's give everything we have. Keep marching.
Yes.
Keep speaking up.
Yes.
Keep speaking out.
Yes.
Be bold.
Yes.
Don't be afraid.
Thank you.
I don't want to go back.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you. You know, people say you should be quiet, you shouldn't make so much noise. But as long as I have breath in my body, I'm going to speak up. So I want to just thank you for inviting me to come by. I'm just a poor boy from rural Alabama, to Tennessee, and then to Georgia. And the people in this country have been so good, so kind. I tell you, I love the city. I love the people here.
We love you!
I love you too.
We love you!
You look good. You look very good.
You've been listening to Congressman John Lewis. John Lewis, presente.
If you see me stumble, don't stand back and look on.
The troopers came toward us with billy clubs, tear gas, bull whips, tramping us with horses. I felt like it was the last demonstration. It was the last protest act on my part. Like I was going to take my last breath from the tear gas. I can never forget Selma. Selma, in a sense, was one of the finest hours in the history of the civil rights movement. When we arrive at the apex of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, we saw a sea of blue, Alabama state troopers. About 600 of us walking in twos. It was a very peaceful, orderly protests.
That march will not continue.
Well, I had no idea that we would be beaten, that we would be trampled or tear gassed. I thought we all would be arrested and jailed. But you come to that point, and I think it's very much in keeping with the philosophy and the discipline of nonviolence, that in spite of the fears, of the misgiving, or the reservations you may have, you tend to lose that sense of fear, and you keep your eyes on the prize. But in Selma, we had a response from the American people. People came there. The days after Bloody Sunday, there was demonstration, nonviolent protest in more than 80 major cities in America. People didn't like what they saw happening there. There was a sense that we had to do something, we had to do it now. We literally, in my estimation, wrote the Voting Rights Act with our blood and with our feet. The movement instilled in me that sense of hope, that sense of faith, that sense of optimism. It doesn't matter really how many bombings, how many beatings, how many jailing. And I did go to jail during that period, 40 times. But you had to have that sense of faith, that sense of hope that you could overcome, you could make this society something different, something better. And I came to the conclusion that our struggle is not one that lasts for one day, one week, a few months, or a few years, but it's a struggle of a lifetime, a many lifetime, if that's what it takes to build the beloved community, the open society.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash, and you've been listening to Building Bridges. Stay strong, stay well.